I'm Tom Hall. Welcome to Midday. To walk through the Reginald F. Lewis Museum of Maryland African American History and Culture's special traveling exhibition, Hateful Things, is to be confronted with images and artifacts that dehumanize and demonize black people. From Little Black Sambo in the 1890s to Halloween masks that parody rappers in the 1990s, these images have been prevalent in media, entertainment, and advertising for generations. Today on Midday, a conversation about how racist stereotypes have endured through history and what it might mean for those stereotypes to be reclaimed. Renee Myers is the Vice President of Inclusion Strategy at Netflix. Dr. Lester Spence is a political scientist and Africana Studies scholar at Johns Hopkins University. The legacy of Jim Crow and moving diversity and inclusion forward. Midday starts right after the news. And good afternoon. Welcome. It's Midday. I'm Tom Hall. Hope you had a good weekend, and thanks for hanging with us this afternoon. The Reginald F. Lewis Museum of Maryland African American History and Culture has a traveling exhibition from the Jim Crow Museum of Racist Memorabilia, which is located in Big Rapids, Michigan. The exhibition is called Hateful Things, and it includes objects from the 19th century through the present that dehumanize African Americans and show in striking and disturbing ways how the pernicious legacy of Jim Crow continues to weave itself into the fabric of the American story. The show is juxtaposed with another smaller exhibition that includes the work of four contemporary African American artists whose work explores how racist stereotypes can be reclaimed. On Saturday afternoon, the Johns Hopkins University Center for Africana Studies is presenting a panel at the Lewis Museum called Unpacking Hateful Things and Contemporary Practices. Two of the panelists join me today here in Studio A. A little later, Dr. Lester Spence of Johns Hopkins University will be here. And now I'm pleased to welcome Renee Myers. She is the recently appointed Vice President of Inclusion Strategy at Netflix. She is the author of two books, Moving Diversity Forward, How to Move from Well-Meaning to Well-Doing, and What If I Say the Wrong Thing? 25 Habits for Culturally Effective People. Ms. Myers, it's a delight to meet you. Thanks for coming in.
Thank you, Tom.
And listeners, if you'd like to join our conversation about inclusion, about reclaiming racist stereotypes, our number here at Midday, 410-662-8780. You can drop us an email, midday@wypr.org. You can send us a tweet at @MiddayWYPR. And thanks to our good pal, Jamila Krimple, we are streaming our conversation from Studio A on the WYPR Facebook page. So, Ms. Myers, I have not had a chance to read your books, but the titles alone are incredibly intriguing. Moving Diversity Forward, How to Move from Well-Meaning to Well-Doing. And there are a lot of well-meaning people, but that leap from well-meaning to well-doing can be a long leap. You could fall in the brink pretty easily. What are the general precepts and the general thesis of that movement from well-meaning to well-doing?
Thank you, Tom. Yeah, we work really hard on those titles. So one of the things we were recognizing is that while people mean well, they haven't necessarily done the work that they need to do to understand what it would mean to act and behave in a way differently than sort of the normal course, the normative way of being in some of these conversations, being in their communities and in their workplaces, which is to say that, you know, if you don't know the right thing to say, but you're not willing to find out what the language is or how it may have changed or advanced. So when you call somebody the wrong name or you actually say something that reveals your bias and someone corrects you on it, then you say, well, that's not what I meant, but you got it all wrong. I'm a really good person. And I think so many of us are vested in our self-image as a good person that we're not willing to do what it takes to actually be one. I think I said in my TED Talk, we don't need any more good people.
Yeah, plenty of those lying around. Yeah, right.
We actually need real people who are willing to unpack their biases, understand what privilege means for those who have it and for those who don't, understanding structural racism, for example, patriarchy, that's hard work. And if you're not willing to dive in to maybe what you've learned, including what you haven't learned and what you've missed and the misinterpretation of history and so forth, then it's unlikely that you're going to be part of the solution.
It's interesting. In this TED Talk that you gave, which I have had a chance to look at, the very first thing you say, you offer three general precepts. And the first one is, we got to get out of denial. And I was interested that you said, and the reason I know this is because I myself am aware of my biases.
Yes.
Now, you're an African-American woman who went to Harvard Law School. I can imagine that you were subjected to all sorts of bias, being a very small minority of demographic at the Harvard Law School.
Yes.
And any law school for that matter. Although that demographic's getting bigger, recognizing our biases and recognizing what's implicit and what's the first step in getting over them?
Fixing
them.
Yeah, so I think that the protest of I'm a good person, so how could I have biases? That's the denial piece that I think really has to go away. So you start looking for your biases once you get out of denial. And they're everywhere. You can find yourself being very judgmental about certain groups of people without a lot of information or contact, no proximity whatsoever to that group, but you somehow have an understanding of how they operate and what their motivation is and why they say what they do and why they don't dress the right way. All of that is bias and it's going unchecked. So the best way to really begin looking, and I do tell the story of being on a plane and hearing a female pilot's voice come over the PA system and being initially like so excited about women being in the sky and being in control. And then the flight gets really turbulent and bumpy. And I'm going, I hope she can drive.
Yeah.
Right? Which you don't know that's a bias. I didn't really realize it was a bias until I was coming back on the other leg and it was a male pilot. It's always a male pilot and it's often turbulent and bumpy. And I never questioned the competence of the pilot. So I'm in the exact same situation, but because the gender of the person in that situation changes, somehow my assessment changes without any information. And so when you start looking for your biases, you'll find them. And that's the beginning of trying to unwind or counter them.
And you do advise that folks do some things that for many people are going to be really difficult. When it comes to young Black men, you say be intentional and purposeful about moving toward them, not away from them.
Yes, yes. Which, of course, is difficult in our country where somehow the color and gender of a person immediately is sending a message of threat for many people in society. Can you imagine? Like just your very presence causes someone to clutch their purse or to move across the street. We've got to get out of that. And of course, in my TED Talk, I was talking specifically about violence against young men of color, young Black men, poor people. And so, again, I think we have to calm down, breathe a little bit, and move forward. Now, maybe it's not on the street late at night in a place where you don't know anybody, but maybe it's in your school or maybe it's your kids' parents, or maybe it's just someone who is in the shopping center and it's in a particular role, right? Unlikely they're going to come back out from the counter and do something terrible to you. There are opportunities, in other words, for us to start developing authentic relationships across race and gender. And perhaps as we get more proximate with people who are different from us, we can try to challenge some of the bias and stereotypes we hold about them.
And let me ask your advice about how folks, white folks, can process, understand, analyze events in the news like we heard a week or so ago. A funeral happening across the street from a high school out in Lansdowne where two young Black men were shot. And this is a funeral of another young Black man. The assailants have not yet been caught, but it's the assumption that they were, in fact, themselves Black men. And so part of this stereotype that people are dealing with, particularly people who live in predominantly white areas, whose only notion of young black men or women is stuff that they see in the media. But, you know, when there is that understandable instinct for fear or even loathing, how do you advise one deals with that?
So I think part of what you already said, Tom, is that's the image that those are the images that get perpetuated through media. And so if all you have is the media, it is unlikely that you'll be able to challenge your biases and your racism, because the whole thing is set up to constantly trade on a set of images. And that's what's getting reported. So what you have to do is say things like, what do I know to be true? What if this happened in a white neighborhood? Because, by the way, people get killed. White people kill white people every day.
Yep.
Okay. But it doesn't seem to get reported. When it is, it doesn't, because whites enjoy the presumption of innocence and the presumption of being good citizens. When we see white people hurting or killing or whatever another white person, they are seen as individuals, bad individuals, versus example of bad group or group that cannot be trusted, which is what happens when the bias is running against you.
They're often
you.
Given the presumption of mental illness.
Yes.
As opposed to the presumption of evil.
Right. And I don't mind.
And that maybe goes back to Jim Crow.
Yes.
I mean, maybe that goes back to these artifacts and objects that we see.
Oh, it's been happening for a very long time. It is so embedded in our systems and in our media and therefore in our psyche as a nation that we are to be afraid of black men, and that the whole culture, black culture, is less than. This is what we call white supremacy. So every time you've decided that this is the problem of the group, in many ways you are buying into a concept of white supremacy.
And why is it then? Maybe that's too dumb a question, but let's figure out the rationale and the history behind the group being blamed. You know, all black people are, you know, violent and evil,
right,
as opposed to, you know, the school shooters.
Right.
You know, the entire white community,
yes,
is not condemned when a school shooter, a white boy, goes and, you know, shoots multiple people. So where does that, is that just the legacy of Jim Crow, literally? Is it, what is it?
I mean, it's hard to unpack completely, but I will say that the way that Jim Crow operated was to resist equality, resist that notion, and to do so by separating people. So while we may have changed some laws, every time we change the laws for the better, there's this force of retrenchment that is saying, let's go back to the status quo where white people are the right people. And so what happens is every time that happens, new laws come up like they did with Jim Crow, because we had reconstruction, and everything was going quite well. We were black people were being voted into Congress and so forth. And then there was the whole campaign to basically disenfranchise black people so they can't vote, so they can't sit on juries, so they can't run for office. And little by little, new laws come in separating black people and white people. As long as people are separated and they are told things about each other, the ignorance is perpetuated. And so I can have an idea about a group of people because I don't live next to them. Their fate is not part of my fate, you know. And so I feel like we still don't have really integrated neighborhoods, even if you look in Baltimore, right? So we have still figured
Absolutely.
Out lots of ways to keep these lines of separation. And so you can make up all sorts of stories. And when certain information is presented, you don't even know how to analyze it because you're so used to having this drum beat of who's good and who's responsible and who's hardworking and who's shiftless. And that stuff gets perpetuated as long as we stay separated.
Yeah, one of the things I learned when I saw this exhibition at the Lewis Museum is that Jim Crow, the term term Jim Crow. This is an actor named Thomas Dartmouth Rice, Daddy Rice. He was a white actor who performed in blackface and invented this character, Jim Crow. But that predates the Civil War by 35 years. So by the time you get to Reconstruction in the 1880s, the 1890s, it's half a century of that stereotype already. You know, plus
the buffoonery,
plus slavery, yes, and all that. Yes. You know, but just so it's sort of it's interesting. So Jim Crow precedes the Civil War, does not succeed. It's not concurrent with Reconstruction, which is an interesting notion. We're going to take a break, but when we come back, we will have more with Renee Meyer. She is the Vice President of Inclusion Strategy at Netflix, and we will also be joined by Dr. Lester Spence of Johns Hopkins University. The launching point for our conversation today is the special exhibition at the Reginald F. Lewis Museum of Maryland After. American History and Culture. It's called Hateful Things. Lester Spence and Renee Myers are part of a panel at the museum next Saturday that explores some of these issues. We will explore them with you when we come back. Our number here at Midday, 410-662-8780. Our email, midday@wypr.org, to send us a tweet at @MiddayWYPR. You can also catch us on the WYPR Facebook page. I'm Tom Hall. Stay with us. Welcome back. It's Midday. I'm Tom Hall. By the way, coming up tomorrow, Ben Jealous is my guest. He is the former president of the NAACP and the Democratic candidate for governor. It's the latest in our series of conversations with the candidates. Mr. Jealous will join me right here in Studio A tomorrow on Midday. If you're just joining us now, we are talking about the legacy of Jim Crow, reclaiming racist stereotypes and ending barriers to diversity and inclusion. Renee Myers is the Vice President of Inclusion Strategy at Netflix. She's the author of Moving Diversity Forward, How to Move from Well-Meaning to Well-Doing, and another book called What If I Say the Wrong Thing? 25 Habits for Culturally Effective People. We are joined now by our good friend, Dr. Lester Spence, a frequent contributor to our program. He's an associate professor of political science and Africana studies at Johns Hopkins University. His latest book is called Knocking the Hustle Against the Neoliberal Turn in Black Politics. Dr. Spence, sir, always a pleasure.
It's good to be here.
If you would like to join our conversation, our number here at Midday, 410-662-8780, our email, midday@wypr.org, to send us a tweet at @MiddayWYPR, to follow me on Twitter at @TomHallWYPR, and you can catch us on the WYPR Facebook page. Lester Spence, I want to get your reaction to a piece in The Sun a couple of days ago about an uproar that came out of a group at the University of Maryland College Park, where the counseling center advertised a thing called White Awake, mm-hmm, as a safe space for white students. And they said on their website that this group offers a safe space for white students to explore their experiences, questions, reactions, and feelings. So there's a reaction to that. Mm-hmm. They've since changed the name of the group. It's now called Anti-Racism and Ally Building Group. And they've basically apologized. But this notion of safe spaces, mm-hmm, for anybody. You're in the university community at Johns Hopkins, and safe spaces is a new term that sort of popped up in just the last few years, mm-hmm, in academia. What's your take?
It's complicated. So I came to the University of Michigan as an undergrad in the fall of 87. The previous year, the 86-87 school year, the university had basically been taken over by activists after a series of racist incidents. A local black sorority was having a meeting in one of the dorms, and somebody slipped a racist flyer under the dorms. Under the door while they were meeting. The campus had a radio station, and one day a campus DJ, a caller into a campus DJ, would just told a string of racist jokes, and the DJ was sharing racist jokes. And then there are a couple of other incidents along with longstanding under-recruitment and under-retention of black faculty and black staff and students to go to the university. And then as a result of that, there are wave of programs designed to increase the number of black faculty and black students. and to extend pedagogically the type of stuff that was being taught in Michigan classrooms. So as I come in as a freshman, I'm actually part of that group of folk who are working on. In fact, we took over the university. We took over the university on MLK Day and made them take it back over. Now, I'd give you that longish history. At no point in time when we were fighting did we ever fight for necessarily safe spaces, right? We did, the university did implement one of the first hate speech codes that made it basically illegal, you know, first modern hate speech code that basically made it legal to make certain types of statements. But we weren't doing that to make an argument that the university should be a safe space for us. What we were doing was we were making a set of arguments about the university as a public institution, that as a public institution that had a certain type of public mission, it should be open to everybody, right? Now, what happens over three decades, right, 87, 88, now we're in 2018, 2019, is this language of what happens is that this public thing that we've been fighting for, that most of my work is about, has transformed into this private thing, right? So to the extent we think about racism, we primarily think about it in individual terms. When we think about university settings, right? We think about universities as these kind of private spaces, and the safe space thing actually evokes home. So one of the arguments that people make is that people, because kids spend 24 hours of their day on campus, that space should be as safe for them as their home is, right? So one of my thoughts about the safe space thing is that we are kind of transitioning, why I understand it, we're transitioning away from the idea of fighting for these spaces as public spaces, as spaces that are democratic spaces that should be open to us because we're citizens, and we're moving more towards this private thing where racism is about individual attitudes, where diversity is really more of about kind of a private thing rather than a public thing.
And, you know, racism, we were saying this in the first segment, Vernay Myers, this individualization of racism. I am a good person. I am not a racist. Yet at the University of Maryland, which we were just talking about, and I don't by any means mean to pick on them, they've already had reports of two hate crimes. And the school's been in session for a week, you know. The number of hate crimes reported by universities and schools, you know, throughout the state, up dramatically in Maryland from last year. So we are having these conversations, the so-called conversation about race is taking place, certainly, you know, 30 years ago when Lester Spence is going to Michigan as an undergraduate, corporations didn't have divisions of diversity and inclusion. They didn't even exist, you know? So now they exist, yet the society writ large, I wonder, you know, if we're making any progress at all.
I'm not sure, but I'm going to tell you what I think about this. It's always really interesting to hear Professor Spence talk about this sort of shift between, you know, let's make this a place where everybody gets to have their rights and their safety to, like, let's move this to an individual space. And I think what has happened is we have these younger people who've come into these institutions thinking that they were going to be open and there was going to be equity and equality and they would find respect. And they're generally shocked that they are walking into these environments after people like Professor Spence has spent all this time and lots of students have created all of these changes and laws and stuff. And they're like, what? This is still happening? It still blows my mind, the power of symbols. And there are some racist symbols that I cannot figure out how we could learn to take the power away from, just like a noose. Just a noose. You can throw a noose pretty much anywhere and create fear.
Which has already happened on the campus in College Park.
Right. And it's like, what other symbols do we have that can just immediately send a message that you are not welcomed and that an individual can do it, Right. So, and then the question is, what is the response of the institution to that kind of thing? But I think the safe space movement is a lot about young people who were born thinking they owned the world of every background. Like, this is good. We're all good. And then maybe we didn't really teach them well enough to understand how resilient these systems of racism are. So they're like, you know what? We don't even want to deal with that. We want a place, we demand a place where I don't have to educate you about why it's not okay to say what you're saying, why you should not be calling the police on me because I'm having lunch in an open space. Like, I don't want to have to deal with that anymore. I pay a lot of money. I'm as good as anybody else. And so is that the right move? Not sure. It could be a combination of things. But I do know that the progress is on some level that they have a sense of entitlement that I don't know if I had when I was coming up. I mean, I had to deal with a lot of exclusion in my college and in my law school. And we actually also demonstrated a lot. Yeah. But I think our kids thought that was all done. And the truth is, it's never done because we have these incredibly resilient racist mentality that is, like I said, embedded even in the best of us.
Vernay Myers is the Vice President of Inclusion Strategy at Netflix. Dr. Lester Spence is an Associate Professor of Political Science and the Co-Director of the Africana Studies Department at Johns Hopkins. I'm Tom Hall. You're listening to Midday, 410-662-8780. Our email, midday@wypr.org. Our Twitter handle, @MiddayWYPR. And you can catch us on the WYPR Facebook page where we're streaming. And Lester Spence, there's this assumption that, as Vernay was intimating, that colleges, universities are these liberal, enlightened places. Yet we see the number of school hate-related vandalism in schools between 2017 and the year before doubled. So it's not just, you know, a 2% increase. I mean, it's doubled. And there is also an assumption that generationally, the students who are in their early 20s now are much hipper, much more open-minded, much less biased.
I just came in from class. That's why I was a little bit late. So I just taught The Souls of Black Folk. And reading The Souls of Black Folk by W.E.B. Du Bois, written in 1903, he argues, like a prophet, that the problem of the 20th century is a problem of color line, not just in America, but abroad. And he also spends a lot of time in that text talking about the role of education. Part of what's happened is we've got kind of an epistemology of ignorance, right? Where a lot of our academic disciplines are not necessarily educating their citizens, their students to be citizens in a way, right? So here's, I'm a political scientist, card carrying. The first journal of political science, the first academic journal, and if not the first, it was one of the first three, was the Journal of Race Development. The Journal of Race Development.
And that dates from?
Between the late 19th and early 20th century. Mm-hmm. So that journal becomes Foreign Affairs. Foreign Affairs is one of the preeminent international relations journals, right? At the moment, the reason it was a Journal of Race Development is because they thought the fundamental unit through which to understand global development was not the nation state. It was the race, right? If you think about revolutions, the three most important revolutions of at least the quote unquote West are the top three are the French, the American, and then the Haitian. But nobody studies the Haitian Revolution. So if you don't really think about if students don't understand how a lot of the elements of what we take to be modernity come from that transatlantic slave trade moment, then there's going to be this ideational gap, right? So that's one hand. But then when you also think about, if you read The Souls of Black Folk, what he talks about consistently, and we don't talk about this enough, is debt, is the role of debt on Black people and the role the role it played in the Jim Crow South on Blacks and whites. And I apologize. I know it's we've got a multicultural society, but you know, at that point in time, he's talking primarily about blacks and whites. If we don't really wrestle with the economic vestiges of that system on whites and blacks, and as well as Latinos and Asian Americans, much less Native Americans, then there's going to be not just this ideational gap, but there's going to be all these different interests that people won't even understand where the interests come from.
And at the Lewis Museum, the sort of corollary exhibition to Hateful Things, which is this traveling exhibition from this place, of all places, the Racial Memorabilia Museum in the United States is in Big Rapids, Michigan.
My boy works with it.
I mean, there must be like one, it's at Ferris State University, it must be like one black person in the entire city of Big Rapids, Michigan. I mean, I'm guessing.
There are a lot of people at Ferris State.
Well, that's good to know.
That was a stereotype, but
I have a friend who teaches at St. Olaf. College, yeah. You know, and I say,
oh, that's a real thing?
It's a real thing.
I just thought she made that up from the Golden Girls.
No. St. Olaf's is a real thing, and he's got this great choir. And I said, man, you got to be the only black person in all of, you know, wherever it is in Minnesota. And he said, yep, I am. And he's one of the finest conductors in the country. But this notion of reclaiming racist stereotypes. And I think perhaps one of our callers wants to touch on that a little bit, if I'm not mistaken. Sharon in White Marsh, welcome to Midday with Renee Myers and Lester Spence.
Hi. Good afternoon. So here's my question. I'm a 50-year-old white woman. I think that I have a pretty open mind. I live kind of out in the woods by a state park, and I often bring the families of inner city people that I work with, come on out here and let's go four-wheeling and do bonfires. But listening to today's conversation is making me think that I have some personal bias, and I'll work on that. But my question is really this. In today's day and age of us trying to be so inclusive with all the races, how does having TV shows titled Blackish or Black Queens, how does that forward us being one united world?
Good question, Sharon.
I feel like it separates me.
Yeah. Well, thanks for the question. Renee Myers, what do you think?
I love the question. Thank you. Because I think it can be really confusing when groups of people that have been marginalized and excluded begin to demand space for their stories and narratives. It feels like they're asking for something extra, or in some ways by having and not just the name or the title, but being unapologetic about telling what life is like for a Black family, which is what Blackish is about, is somehow separating us. My belief is that for so many centuries and decades, especially on the TV, we've been hearing one story, and that story is causing the separation, because that story is really maintaining this idea of white families, white, this is the way you do things, this is how you dress, this is what humor looks like, this is what drama looks like. And it's just the same thing with gender. Like, I am so grateful for the media where women are telling their stories, and stories that you would not hear because of the paternalistic and all sorts of domination of men. And so I think I can understand why people go, oh, I don't know if that's like, we are the world. Shouldn't we be doing that? And I'm thinking that there is going to be a leveling by having new stories that will cause us to see not only the differences, but also the commonality. So where we overlap around family, but also, I mean, because I'm just using family because she talked about Blackish, but also what are unique experiences, and therefore we're not as ignorant about why someone might feel differently, vote differently, want to live somewhere else. So I'm hoping that's helpful.
Yeah, of course, and the families that we're getting to know on television now are very different than the families we got to know in the 1970s. That's a whole other thing. All right, well, more on reclaiming racist stereotypes when we come back from a quick break with Renee Myers. She is the Vice President of Inclusion Strategy at Netflix, and Dr. Lester Spence, an Associate Professor of Political Science and African Americana Studies at Johns Hopkins. They are two of the five panelists discussing issues raised by the special exhibition at the Reginald F. Lewis Museum of Maryland African American History and Culture. It's called Hateful Things. The panel takes place Saturday afternoon. And by the way, the Lewis Museum has a big show of the works of the African American visionary artist Romare Bearden coming up in November. So we've got a link to the Lewis Museum website at wypr.org/midday. More of our conversation when we come back. 410-662-8780, our email midday@wypr.org to send us a tweet at @MiddayWYPR. You can also catch us on the WYPR Facebook page. Before we take a break, each week here on Midday, it's our practice to read the names of the people who've lost their lives to violence in the previous week. We stand in witness to their untimely deaths, and we remember their families and friends in their hour of grief. So far in 2018, 205 people in Baltimore City have lost their lives to violence. Five of the six men who were killed 2 weeks ago have now been named by the police. They are Carlos Bridges, age 26, Michael Brown, Jr., age 26, Bobby Mack, age 24, Demetric Jones, age 21, and Clarence Payne, age 63. Four people were the victims of homicide in Baltimore last week. Three have been identified so far. They are Gregory Kaysen, age 43, Shauna Davis, age 26, and Arlie Granados, age 30. It's Midday. I'm Tom Hall. Stay with us. Welcome back. It's Midday. I'm Tom Hall. If you've just joined us, we're talking about reclaiming racist stereotypes. There's a special exhibition at the Reginald F. Lewis Museum of Maryland African American History and Culture. It's called Hateful Things, which includes artifacts from the 19th century through the present that advance and perpetuate racial bias. In conjunction with that exhibition on Saturday, my guests will be part of a panel that explores how these objects, and even the very old ones, shape the conversation about race today. Renee Myers is an author and an attorney. She has recently been appointed the Vice President of Inclusion Strategy at Netflix. Her books include Moving Diversity Forward, How to Move from Well-Meaning to Well-Doing, and What If I Say the Wrong Thing? 25 Habits for Culturally Effective People. Dr. Lester Spence is a political scientist on the faculty of Johns Hopkins University. He'll be moderating the panel, which also includes the literary historian Lawrence Jackson, the cultural historian Martha Jones, and the political scientist Rob Lieberman. You can join our conversation at 410-662-8780, our email midday@wypr.org, our Twitter handle @MiddayWYPR, and we are streaming on the WYPR Facebook page. Let's go to the phones again. Janet in Baltimore County, welcome to Midday. Thanks for calling.
Hello. Thank you. I just want to talk about a incident in the vein of the purse-clutching thing, and then I want to ask a wider question. Okay, the incident is, a couple of months ago, I was going to the library. I'm almost 70 years old. I'm a dumpy-looking white woman, and I was going along to the library, and there were some trees along the street with some very interesting blooms. So I was glancing at them, and I turned the corner to go up to the library entrance, and there were still some of these trees on the corner, so I was glancing backwards at the trees still. And I hear like a snort and like a behind me and like a little bit of muttering. And I look back, and there was a young middle-aged black woman coming along the sidewalk behind me about 15 or 20 feet back. So I think she was thinking that I was glancing back in fear of her, possibly, but I didn't know that. So I didn't speak with her, and, you know, that was a case of possibly misunderstanding of white fear. And the other question I have is if the media are always presenting black people, such as in movies, et cetera, as bad people, then how can you blame white people if the white people don't have much interaction with black people? How can you blame white people for fearing black people?
All right. Well, thanks for that comment, Janet. Lester, what do you think? What's your response to Janet?
That's actually a really good question. I don't tend to think of these things as in terms of blame, right? I just tend to think of them as far as, you know, again, my whole thing is about extending the public, extending the capacity for which citizens can govern in a city like Baltimore, which is a majority black, you know, to extend the power of black people to govern. What do we have to do to make it possible for black people to actually work and function as full citizens? So, you know, and then if you actually think about it, the more I think about that, there's this tendency when we write about or talk about race, we talk about it as if black people are the ones who are the ones that are kind of damaged psychologically or culturally, as if white people were okay. What the sister points to is a possibility that whites are actually damaged by this dynamic. So to that extent, it's not about assessing blame necessarily. It's about figuring out what is it we can do where whites in this instance can be made actually psychologically whole. Because, I mean, if you look back at something like Emmett Till, I mean, they killed Emmett Till because he allegedly whistled at a woman. I don't think we can go too far with this, but what would you call somebody who killed a kid for whistling at someone? I'm a political scientist. I'm not a psychologist, but it seems to me that's a specific type of crazy. So what do we have to do, you know, as a society to make it where people can be sane and people can be whole and people can govern?
Renee Myers?
And I would also say, how can we create the benefit of the doubt for each other such that in that situation, when she heard the huffing or the what she presumes is an assessment that was incorrect about what she was doing, how is it that we could turn to that person and say, hey, how's it going? Can you believe these flowers? Because all the time we're missing each other and misinterpreting each other and misunderstanding each other. And it doesn't happen just across race, right? It happens across human beings generally, but it also gets reinforced or made more difficult for us to take that next step, which is to give a person the benefit of the doubt and to see if there's a connection that's available. I think the more we learn to do that, the more we will be creating a space that everybody can feel safe in. And I love also what the professor said here, because this is so not about blame, but when we go into blame, we go into defense mode. We don't need defense. We need offense in this area, right? We need people to stretch. We need people to learn. We need folks to be aware of the extent to which they may be responsible, even complicit, and maybe not consciously so. But then what would that mean they want to do differently? Because if you're not happy with where we are right now, everybody's got to find their thing that they can do to change it.
Andrew Gillum, Democratic candidate for governor in Florida, along with two other African-Americans running for governor, one right here in Maryland, Ben Jealous, who's going to be my guest tomorrow on the show, and Stacey Abrams in Georgia. He talked at a panel that included those three very extraordinary people, because there are no black governors at the moment in the United States, and there could be as many as three by the time we wake up November 7th.
That we know of.
Yeah.
You know
right.
how race works.
Right. Yes, well
no,
said.
I think you should explain that. I don't know if everybody understands what you're saying.
There are a number of people, there are a number of people who've been passing, and there are a number of people who may actually have black family members who aren't aware of that. I mean, all this stuff, race is a political, race is a political
category. It's not a genetic thing.
It's not a genetic thing.
Right. But of course, Gillum's white opponent, Congressman Ron DeSantis, cautioned that he didn't want his voters to monkey this up. So this is a, you know, some people called it a dog whistle. Some people called it a clarion call. I mean, depending on your orientation, I guess. But again, these kinds of incidents very much affect the political dynamic in a really serious way. I mean, Gillum makes the point that because of that kind of insensitivity, because of that kind of comment, that the political strategy of, as he says, you know, running in the South as Republican light isn't the way to go. So he's making a case for progressive politics in Florida. Ms. Abrams is making a case for progressive politics in Georgia. And Mr. Jealous is making the same case here in Maryland. So the ramifications of this kind of rhetoric transcend more than just, you know, was that a nice thing to say?
Well, and I wouldn't categorize, that's not insensitive. That's racist, right? I mean, that's really, we should really be able to call things what they in fact are. I mean, that is racist. And we know that is funny, though, because there was a moment in time when being explicit didn't work because we had these anti-racist principles that would make that type of explicit thing not polite. And because it was impolite, people wouldn't support it. But particularly after the election of Trump, we now know some colleagues of mine at the University of Michigan have done research to show pretty definitively that it doesn't matter anymore whether it's implicit or whether it's explicit.
Yes, yeah, it's not even a dog whistle
way.
Anymore.
Yeah. And mucking things up, that's not implicit. That's pretty explicit. And we should be able to, I'm a political scientist, I'm not a journalist, but it seems to me that one of the things that journalists need to get back to, or not get back to, they need to kind of redefine what truth means. Like, it should be a journalist principle to say something like that is racist. And you're not tainting, you're not biasing, you're stating an objective fact.
And I'm not hedging it when I say some people say this is a dog whistle, because some people are still saying.
No, that's right.
There are people
that's right.
who recognize this not as a blatantly racist comment, but as a sort of subtle thing. And, you know, so again, that perspective, that orientation is really important.
I mean, I think one of the things is that you can always say that you wouldn't be crazy to think that it was racist or that it was pointed because it's been allowed for so long. And I also think that some people then just parrot some of these words and languages and ways of being, and they don't understand that they are part of a much larger system of keeping this racist language and policies in place. I actually did a show recently where a man called in and said, you know, I am learning so much about my ignorance. And I would say that is one progressive thing, or one maybe positive optimistic thing, is that more people are trying to get their work done from who are white. They are really trying to understand what they've been missing. And he said, you know, I told my friend one time I went to a flea market and I did a great job. I got a great bargain. He said, I really Jewed them down. And his friend was like, what? He was like, I really Jewed them down. He goes, man, do you understand where that comes from? He goes, no, I mean, he's like, no, I don't. He said, I thought it was like a French word, like Jew. But I'm telling you, the level of ignorance is
quite
more
game,
than we can imagine. There are some very, very intentional people. And then there are people who have just been living in the smog.
Yeah. We have time for a very, very quick phone call. Aliva in Catonsville, you literally have 20 seconds. Thanks for calling. Sorry.
Oh, okay. Hi. I guess I have a comment for all the callers who are saying, what can we do if media presents black people as scary? What can we do in these situations? And I have a whole lot of different answers. And one of them is white people can stop being defensive. White people can stop asking black people to stop being angry about racism. We can become more media literate. We can look at the media we're consuming and we can say, maybe that media that's painting the black people as angry isn't accurate and maybe they have an agenda. We can question why the media is doing what it's doing.
Those are good points, Aliva. I very much appreciate it, and we're going to give you the last word. Dr. Lester Spence is an associate professor of political science at Hopkins. His latest book is called Knocking the Hustle: Against the Neoliberal Turn in Black Politics. Renee Myers is vice president of inclusion strategy at Netflix. I am grateful to you both and look forward to the next time. Thank you.
Thank you,
Tom.
The panel that Dr. Spence and Ms. Myers and other scholars will take part in starts at 1 o'clock Saturday afternoon at the Reginald F. Lewis Museum of Maryland African American History and Culture. We've got a link to it on our website, wypr.org/ Midday. That's it for us today. Coming up tomorrow, my guest is the Democratic nominee for Governor Ben Jealous. He'll spend the hour with me here in Studio A. Thanks to The Diz for supplying lunch today for our guests. The Diz is located at 300 West 30th Street in the heart of Remington. They feature signature burgers, wings, steaks, and jumbo lump crab cakes. The Diz is open for lunch and dinner with breakfast served on the weekends. On the web at thedizbaltimore.com. Here and Now is coming up next after the news at the top of the hour. I'm Tom Hall. Thanks for being with us. We'll see you tomorrow. Have a great day.